new chapter. We'll be spending this week and next week on this chapter. Well, actually, the third week we will deal with the latter part as we move into chapter 15. But we want to remember that we are in the midst of this section that deals with the seven personages. We're coming to the end. Chapter 15 begins the seven bowls. And we will be introduced really next week to the seventh personage, which is the Great Whore of Babylon. And we'll save most of our comments till for that for later on. But so anyway, keep that in mind. But as we have seen here, there's always been in these a situation in which what's happening with God's people. And so we see a little bit of that today in the first five verses of chapter 14. Of course, we've seen how that they have been forced out into the wilderness. The beast has turned its attention, and well, the dragon threw the beast and the false prophet and persecuting the church. But as we come to the end of the section, we kind of get a little bit of a different glimpse here. Now we see the church in heaven in glory, not on earth, because now we're getting ready to see the final judgment, which we'll see in the latter part of chapter 14. So we don't see them and what's going on with him on earth. We kind of see here a picture of the very end where the church is glorified on earth, not being persecuted by the beast. And then we'll see Christ coming and bringing judgment upon them as this section closes. Every section is closed with a coming of the Lord, but as I said would happen, more detail is started to be given at the final judgment, the second coming, than what's going on earth during this time. And so you kind of see that happening as well. Well, let's just catch up with we're introduced to the beast and the false prophet last week. The beast represents the governments and the powers that directly persecute the church. The false prophet represents more so the false religions and perhaps the worldviews that arise out of that that more effectively cause problems for the church. Error has always done more damage to the church, certainly, than outward persecution. But these should not be regarded or regulated to just one form or person, but a continual onslaught throughout church history. I believe that if you try to look at that as one person, you either make the mistake of relegating it to the Pope, for instance, as the Reformers did, or to something that's going to happen in the future. A lot of people spend all their time trying to find if the beast is alive today, the Antichrist. Instead of saying, no, this represents an attitude, an influence, things that the church has to deal with, regardless of what age they live in. Then we talk about the mark of the beast that we'll get into a little more today. And that is anything that one does in order to get along in the world. If we could go on to say it has more to do with the gospel issue. In other words, not everything that we are required to do in this world is wrong, but when we have to deny Christ, when we have to deny the Bible and truth, then it becomes wrong, right? So examples of how this has always been the case was where the early church in Rome had to say Caesar is Lord. I should have had quotes there before Caesar, excuse me. But that if they didn't do that, they would be persecuted one way or another. We talked about how baptizing babies often was an example of the mark of the beast. Now let me clarify, there are many today who baptize babies, and I don't believe they are taking on the mark of the beast. Obviously, you got Presbyterians and something like that. But during the church age, often it was a gospel issue because they taught that when you baptized that baby, he was freed from original sin, he was regenerated, more or less saved, or at least began the process of salvation. And so those who believed that baptism was for the believers only would not do that, and they were persecuted for it. And under those conditions, it was a gospel issue, just like taking the Mass. If you didn't take the Mass, if you lived in an area where Catholicism kind of ruled the day, then it was a gospel issue because you didn't take it because you understood that your sins were not forgiven in that ceremony. It was forgiven by faith in Jesus Christ once for all. So these were gospel issues. So they involve denying Christ and the gospel, not just doing things that the culture is doing. Some people, again, you pick on fundamentalism, but that's kind of an example. Anything the culture is doing is bad, and you can't do anything, no matter whether it's really unbiblical or not. And that's going way overboard. I remember a preacher growing up, and he would say, well, when the world moves this way, the church shouldn't just stay where it's at. The church should move the other way. Well, wait just a minute. What if you're doing what you should be doing, why do you gotta stop doing and start doing something different? I mean, what's going on here? You know, and he would say something, often the church moves along with it. And I agree, that is a problem. But our goal is to do what the Bible tells us, not to say, well, if the world does it, or if the culture does it, if it becomes a fad or in style, we can't do it, we've got to do something totally different. Well, that just makes yourself look odd, but if it's not unbiblical, why? It's not the mark of the beast to do things that is going on in the culture around us, unless, of course, that is unbiblical, and then it becomes different. So, sometimes you just got to step back and think things through, and often we don't. We also saw 666, the mark of the beast is a failure of Satan and man to live up to the perfection of God, and we reminded ourselves that we always fall short in everything we do and pursue, and that it takes Christ, the perfect one, to save us from ourselves. So, before we get started in the first five verses of chapter 14, let's remember that we are studying the seven personages, and we are looking at things kind of from behind the scenes. Instead of just seeing persecution and martyrdom, we're seeing that there's the force behind it, the beast, the false prophet, the dragon. We're seeing why the world hates us as it does, and why it does some of the things that it does. And so as we come to the end of the section, we will see an allusion or a description of the final judgment, as well as a look at the condition of the redeemed, in this case, those who have already gone to heaven. I think we see really the church triumphant in heaven. And it's kind of an ongoing structure. Let's just talk a little bit more about the mark of the beast and the use of numbers in the book of Revelation as well as the Bible at large. In the Hebrew language as well as other, especially ancient languages, there was not a separate numerical system as we have 1, 2, 3, and 4. They would merely use letters and they would have designated numerical values. So for instance, if we were doing that in the English language, we would say A is number 1, B would be number 2. And they would put a little tick of some sort next to the word to let you know that I am using this not as a word, but in a numerical sense. And it was called grammatria. And you would, that's how they would write their numbers often. And so this began, at least as far back as ancient Babylon. And while on the one hand it can be useful, in other words, you kind of had to do that. You had to have some sort of numerical way to write numbers and so forth. It developed into numerology. Now, that's not always bad. It can be bad. It's not necessarily bad. But as we'll see here, I'll try to give you some examples. But because of that, if you think about it, if every letter also had a numerical value, while you didn't always look at it that way, specifically, you could. Because you could take a letter, like a name for instance. Let's take Nero as the thing that Jeff put in the bulletin board, which is good, and I agree with all that. You can make Nero, because every letter has a numerical value, it can come up to some sort of value, and it could, some have seen, come up to 666. Hebrew, the Hebrew language has no vowel, so you would always you could only use consonants. Every consonant had those numerical values. For instance, in Hebrew, the word for alive, as I understand it, has a numerical value of 18. And so I guess because it speaks of life, for whatever reason, it became a lucky number or a lucky name or word for the Jews using numerology. Now, on one hand, we'd say anything lucky is idolatry, but that's what you can do with numerology because of this particular of adding numerical values to letters. But it isn't always bad. But the problem is, and I'll show this in a minute, it is when you take this way too far that you have a problem. It can add beauty to a language because you start to appreciate how people have taken language and letters, and because of their numerical value, put them together in such a way to add beauty to what they are doing. For instance, Matthew chapter 1, we have, as we read the first few verses there, we find out that there were 14 generations from Abraham to David. Then from David to the exile, there were 14 generations. And then from there on to Christ, there was another 14 generations. And the name value for the most common form of David comes up to 14. And so people who see that and who get into that kind of thing, see this as a way that Matthew emphasizes David as the greater, emphasizes David and his son then as the greater David. They're using 14, which is really a multiple of 7, right? A doubling of 7. To emphasize it, so they in fact they had to leave out some generations in some people in those genealogical lists in order to come to 14. But they did it on purpose to beautify it, to make it lovely, to emphasize at the end of the day they're emphasizing Christ. And so that's a way to bring beauty and order to something. But to take numerology and to find a hidden meaning. Now that's a whole other issue. Since numbers play such a big role in this book, and 666 in particular, people have pushed it way beyond what we can reasonably prove and made it to be a book more about secret codes and symbols rather than to make it symbolic, make the thoughts be symbolic of something, certainly more than the revelation of Jesus Christ himself. So, for instance, if you've ever read the book, and I don't recommend it by any stretch, the Da Vinci Code, that's an example of someone trying to find, through numerology and other things, the Bible to be a book of secret codes that need to be unlocked, rather than about Jesus Christ, and completely miss the point. And that's what people have done with the book of Revelation. Because you can make every word add up to something, you make it a book of secret codes that if you can unlock it, God is somehow saying that if you unlock this thing, you will understand the future or perhaps the day in which you live, instead of making it about Jesus Christ. And using these symbols to teach us about that. And so for 2,000 years, there has been no end to the way people have tried to find names that add up to 666. And it began with Nero and different Caesars, right up until Henry Kissinger, and most every leader since then, it seems anyway. And the problem with most of these is that they always have to do you have to force some unusual spelling or something like that for it to really work. In other words, often they have to force it or do something that leaves you wondering if that really legit. And we could spend the rest of our lives just studying the books that write about this subject. But because this number represents the name of the beast and the Antichrist, and is said to be put on one's forehead or right hand, that also leads to all sorts of speculation. And obviously one such popular theory is that it is going to be a barcode, that the mark of the beast is not something that identifies someone as being worldly or being lost, but the mark of the beast is something that is literally put on one's body. Well, this week, the family sat down and we watched a movie that none of us had ever watched before, A Thief in the Night, which came out in the 70s. I can't really recommend that. It's just so sad, but it's about what happened when the rapture took place and all that, what the mark of the beast would be. And of course, it was something that was tattooed on your forehead or your arm and all this kind of stuff. And it works well if one assumes that when the Lord comes back and that the Antichrist was always pointing to some distant future thing. And it really couldn't have happened until the late 70s, because it wasn't until the late 70s that the barcode, for instance, even really came to be in use. I remember I worked at a grocery store. We had to peel off every last price tag that we used to use guns to price everything. Everything in the store had to be removed because we were going to start using barcode the next day. And so, and of course now there's any number of ways with modern technology to use such a device. And so again, it leads to every kind of speculation and ends up, forget it, missing the point, as we've talked about, the gospel issue of all this. And another thing to keep in mind is that the term Antichrist is never found in the book of Revelation. It's only in John's epistles later on that we find it. And the beast is found in any number of political entities, but we can't assume that this refers primarily to one person at the end of the age any more than what we have already seen in history so far. In other words, you have to assume that there's going to be an Antichrist at the end who's going to use that, all this, in a very literal, physical way. But what you find out, if what we're saying is right, and there's other ways that you can take on the mark of the beast, you don't need a barcode, you don't need technology, it's been going on from the very beginning, and I think that is certainly the case. And so the problem with trying to force this into some modern day technology, or for future person, is that it ignores, the fact that this has been going on since the very beginning of the church. There has always been times in which God's people have been persecuted if they don't buy into the worldly system. And that's what you see, because people think, well, God's going to rapture everybody, this mark of the beast is going to come, and you fail to say, wait just a minute, I need to worry about the mark of the beast in my own day and age. I need to worry about the ways that I can grab hold of what this culture is selling and, in a sense, sell my soul to it or demean the name of Christ instead of worrying about what's going to happen in the future. Right now, some are trying to push in California, maybe other places too, I'm sure, the loss of tax exemption if Christian universities don't allow homosexuals and transsexuals into their school system. And that's an example of the mark of the beast. You're either going to say, no, this is what the Word of God says, and this is how we are going to run our organization, whether or lose it, but we're not going to succumb to worldly pressure to deny God's Word, what's right and wrong. They also fail to remember that the mark of the saints in chapter 7 is spiritual, and so in order to kind of support questionable interpretations, they say the mark of the beast must be physical, regardless of the fact that in chapter 7, the mark of the saint was a spiritual thing. It was an inner thing. It's quite possible that the first century saint, when reading this, perhaps immediately thought of Nero. Perhaps they took that name and they were used to that and they thought of Nero or some such person. And that would make perfect sense. But since this is, I believe, a reoccurring entity, it is not necessary for us to know or have one person that it refers to. Someone wisely said that the book of Revelation is a book of symbols, but not riddles. And I would agree with that. I think that's what we've seen a lot of ways that his use of the Old Testament, for instance, symbolizes truths that he's talking about, but it's not some kind of hidden code that once you get it, you see something that others don't. And so, having said all that, as we come to chapter 14, we notice that this 144,000 are the ones who we saw in chapter 5, or chapter 6, excuse me, chapter 7, who have a mark on their foreheads, which we learned was a seal that they were gods. And so, who are these 144,000? I would say they are the saints of God, the same ones that we saw in chapter 7. We see them now triumphant. In chapter 7, they were the ones who were on earth still being persecuted, sealed by God, saved, but still on earth. The innumerable multitude were the ones in heaven. Now we see them at the end of the age, they're all standing in heaven, and we're going to see here, they're singing a song of redemption, rejoicing in the Lord as he destroys and brings to an end this world. So it's quite an amazing sight as you read through the entire chapter. Now, some people see this as a subset of Christians, perhaps Jews who were saved during the supposed tribulation. And if we take verses 4 and 5 in a physical way, then you'd almost have to see them as a subset, because verses 4 and 5 say they are virgins who have not defiled themselves with women, so they have to be men, and they have to be literal virgins. And so now you've got a whole problem trying to figure out who they are. But if we see them as in verses 4 and 5 as a description that we would expect to read of Christians, then they don't have to be a subset, but they can represent all Christians. And I'm going to try to make that point. Since we have already tried to make the case that they stand for all the redeemed, as assuming what we read in chapter 7, we notice here that they sing a song that only the redeemed can sing, so I think that would add weight to the fact that these are Christians. It says that they stand on Mount Zion with the Lamb. So, again, it's not a subset of Christians who are standing in Jerusalem with Jesus, reigning from Jerusalem, but they are the redeemed, it says, standing in Zion, and I believe Zion speaks of, see here, I'll try to show you some verses in a moment, speaks of the kingdom of God in particular. It says, why 144,000? Well, we've seen this is a multiple of 12 times 12, 12 representing the church in the Old Testament and the New Testament. 10 of multiples, a 10 usually speaks of a number, of a great number. And so I think it represents believers in the Old and New Testament. Zion, I think, is a reference, generally speaking, in the Bible that speaks of Jerusalem, but in a glorified kingdom sense. Let me give you some examples of that. Joel 2:31. The sun shall be turned to darkness and the moon to blood before the great and awesome day of the Lord comes. And it shall come to pass that everyone who calls on the name of the Lord shall be saved. For in Mount Zion and in Jerusalem there shall be those who escape, as the Lord has said, and among the survivors shall be those whom the Lord called. And again, a reference to Mount Zion, particularly where the temple was, and Jerusalem. Often in the Old Testament, Zion is equated with Jerusalem, the city itself. And then in Romans 11:26, and in this way all Israel will be saved, as it is written, the deliverer will come from Zion, he will banish ungodliness from Jacob. Zion, again, often speaks, it. Zion was an old term that spoke of Jerusalem, but it often when it's used in prophecy, it's speaking of a future glorified time, the time of the kingdom.
And we see this kind of brought out here. Hebrews kind of uses it like this in 12:22. But you have come to Mount Zion, to the city of the living God, the heavenly Jerusalem, and to the innumerable angels in festive gathering. So you see here, it's speaking of you've come to the church, you've come to the kingdom, you've entered into the heavenly Jerusalem, as it were. And so it came to be symbolized often as the kingdom of the Messiah, the glorious future of the true Israel. It is used in the Psalms and prophecies to speak more of a spiritual, glorious aspect of the kingdom, as we see how Hebrews picks up on that. And so, again, for that reason, I believe that what we're seeing here is the glorified church with Christ playing these harps, singing this song as the Lord destroys the earth. And so it says here that this song of the redeemed is pretty impressive. It says that it sounds like the roar of many waters. I think of a waterfall, right? If you've ever been to Niagara Falls, for instance, but really any decent sized waterfall, it's pervasive. Its noise is above everything else. You can't get away from it. It demands attention. It can't be drowned out. It really drowns out everything else. And it's saying that as the redeemed are singing this song of the redeemed, the song of how they were redeemed by Christ, it's what's prevalent in heaven. Glory and praise to God. It goes on continually in heaven, just as the Niagara Falls. You know, I was thinking about that. I'm not standing at the falls right now, right? But I know that even though I don't hear it, it's always thundering at Niagara Falls. And so in heaven, they're always singing this. It's a constant praise. And too often we get so caught up in our lives that we forget that we're supposed to be part of this, singing this song, as it were. But someday we'll be in glory and we do it as we ought to, right? So the harps we've seen that they're using speaks of victorious celebration in the book of Revelation. But I want you to notice something in chapter 18. While this is going on, what we find the world in Revelation 18, verse 22, when it comes to the earth's final demise, what do we read here? And the sound of harpists and musicians, of flute players and trumpeters will be heard in you no more. Talking about the world. And the craftsmen of any craft will be found in you no more. And the sound of the mill will be heard in you no more. And the light of the lamp shall shine in you no more. And the voice of the bridegroom and the bride will be heard in you no more. For the merchants were the great ones of the earth, and all the nations were deceived by your sorcery. And in her was found the blood of the prophets and the saints, and of all who have been slain on earth. While our rejoicing and music goes on forever, the time is coming when that will cease in this earth. In Revelation, I think it's making that very plain. It's something we need to remember as we get so caught up in, I think about this stupid music awards and all that stuff that the world does. And what's so nauseating about that is not necessarily the music. It might be good, it might not be good. It's the love that you see in the people. Like, this is all that matters. Get this award and to give it, and to dress up and let everybody see you. It's like that they live for that stuff as if it really matters, but it's all going to be gone. It's all coming to naught. And it's so easy for Christians to kind of put so much emphasis on these things. Well, in verses 4 through 5, we kind of come to the hard part, the more difficult thing to understand here, because they're described in a very unusual way. We've seen who they are and what they're singing, but now we see what they're like, which I think helps us understand how we're supposed to see this. This is a description of saints. Not a group in the future during the tribulation, a group of Jewish men or some kind of men who don't get married, who don't have sex, and all this kind of nonsense. This is a description of the church, men and women. And if we see this as physical, as some do, and not spiritual or symbolic, then we're saying, okay, why is it just men? And it would make us assume, well, why is it that these men, by remaining virgins and not touching women, are more holy? Why are the women, why do the women defile them? You begin to have all these scenarios that make no sense. How come women defile men but not vice versa? And it creates all sorts of problems that many have fallen to throughout the ages, certainly through the church age, because they read stuff like this and they immediately see it only in the physical and not the spiritual, in the spiritual meaning. And it certainly has fed the ego of some men who see themselves as perhaps more holy or better in some way than their wives or than women, that being with women is defiling in some way, which the Bible knows nothing of. Certainly we know how Roman Catholicism has done that, to teach that if the priest must be celibate because that is a more holy situation than a married person, and nuns have to be celibate. Instead, I think the second phrase here helps us understand what's being alluded to, where it says that, okay, what does it mean by they have not defiled themselves with women? For they are virgins, if it is these who follow the Lamb wherever he goes. I think, again, the idea here is that they have not succumbed to spiritual adultery with this world, but they, Christians, are those who are true to Christ. So they are virgins in that sense. They're pure. In 1 Corinthians 7, Paul suggested that men and women might remain single so that they may better serve the Lord in an unfettered way, but he also made it clear that he's saying that because of the current distress, because of the great persecution, he says it might be better for some to remain as I am, that is, unfettered with the family because of the persecution. But he goes on to say, as we'll see here in a moment, that it don't have to be, that that's just because of what's going on. But there are those who read stuff like that, and they think that somehow it's better to be single or celibate than not. So he was merely saying to choose to remain unmarried spoke of total devotion to Christ in the current situation. You are not, because if you know that there's persecution out there, then any time you can be dragged away from your family and put your family in distress, it's going to be more difficult for you to serve than those who are unfettered, who don't have to worry about family. We all know how that would work. Of course, it also meant that as a single person, there would be ways you could not minister that only a married person could too. So we have to keep that in mind. But it speaks of spiritually to all saints who are married to Christ, in that they are true to him above all else, as a married person is to be devoted to their spouse above all others. I don't believe it's teaching that celibacy is holier than being married, let alone that intercourse in some way is less holy than celibacy. You think about how this has destroyed lives, not just in Roman Catholicism, but for instance, in the early church, this kind of started to take hold. Origen, who was a church father, who had a lot of issues, take my word for it, he's not someone that we would hold up as doctrinally sound in a lot of ways, he castrated himself because he felt like this is what the Bible taught. But in 1 Corinthians 7, Paul says that singleness or being married is a gift of God. Both are fine. You have to live according to God's gift. So he said, I wish that all were as myself, I myself am, but each has his own gift from God, one of one kind or one of another. So the Bible never says that one is better than the other. But the Bible also, when he created man before the fall, instituted marriage, which meant he was instituting intercourse before the fall, so there's nothing wrong with it. And so, for that reason, to say that it is sinful in some way, or less holy, makes no sense. We are told to be fruitful and multiply. How can we do that if we don't have marriage? So you see the problem here. We can add to this that many Christians are not only married, but if you say this is a description of Christians, how many of us have failed to be chaste physically as we ought to, that we have fallen into one sin or another? And so you have to me, you've got to take this as a general description of Christians and not physically as those who have never sinned in that way. Because then you would have to relegate it to just some little subset somewhere. So I think it helps to understand verse 5 as not literally describing a saint in a physical sense, but in the overall lifestyle. Those that make it to heaven are those who demonstrate a life that is given over to serving the Lord. And the Old Testament is full of allusions to Israel and how they did not remain faithful to the Lord, and it uses adultery as imagery. So I think all John is doing is using that kind of imagery to describe being faithful to the Lord, to be pure. The New Covenant saint is never seen in that light because we have the Holy Spirit to keep us faithful. Ezekiel 36:27, I will put my spirit within you and cause you to walk in my statutes and be careful to obey my rules. Because the Old Testament saint did not, well, the Old Testament Israelite, by and large, didn't have any of that. And we see them falling into adultery, but we are a pure church. What is Ephesians, I think I have that down here somewhere. Coming up to it. Oh yeah, in Ephesians, we'll get to it in a second. I'll say that, but we see how we're described in the New Testament as a holy church that God presents, that Christ presents to the Father. I'll get to that in just a moment. But the fact that symbolism here speaks of how the ancient Israelites was to keep himself from sexual contact helps us understand why John, I think, uses this in this case. In other words, in Deuteronomy 23:9, when you are encamped against your enemies, this is speaking to the army of men, who, as they got ready for battle, you shall keep yourself from every evil thing, and that would be taken not necessarily as sinful, but anything that would make you ceremonially impure. If any man among you becomes unclean because of a nocturnal emission, then he shall go outside the camp. He shall not come inside the camp. And then we see this again in 1 Samuel 21:4. And the priest answered David, I have no common bread on hand, but there is holy bread. But the young men have kept themselves from women. And David answered the priest and said, truly, women have been kept from us, as always when I go on an expedition, as we just read here, for instance. The vessels of the young men are holy even when it is ordinary journey. How much more today will their vessels be holy? So he's basically, you see here, the priest says they can have this bread, but they have to be ceremonially clean. I mean, but the whole point is that under the law that we are not under anymore, certain activities made one ceremonially unclean to go to the temple, to do certain things. Didn't mean they were sinful. There were ways to purify themselves. But we see John using these illustrations of people who are keeping themselves pure, are not touching anything that would make them ceremonially unclean, or in our case, would defile us in a sinful way. And so that's what John is doing here. They are engaging in the Lord's battles, and they were to take care of remaining pure before the Lord. And so he describes the saints in the same way. And you say, well, why are you taking all this time to point this out and to make us uncomfortable and read verses that kind of make us uncomfortable, right? Well, we do that so that we can appreciate the symbolism that John is using and not try to force it into ways that go way beyond what John means to force, like they have done with priests and nuns and so forth like that, and so many times in church history, and try to force upon us to live in a natural way, because at the end of the day, most people are not given the gift of celibacy. And when you take verses like this and abuse them, much abuse has been done because people have not studied the Bible well. And so I think verses 4 and 5 is simply the people who have God's mark contrasted with those who bear Satan's mark, which we know for instance, in 22 verse 15, it says, outside, this is out those who are outside of the kingdom, outside of the New Jerusalem, are the dogs and the sorcerers and the sexually immoral and the murderers and idolaters and everyone who loves and practices falsehood. So you've got the saints who are symbolized or described as virgins who are pure, have not done anything that defiled them, and then you've got those who have the mark of the beast who are not, and they're everything that the saint is not. And again, you don't want to just skip over the fact that it reminds us that we are to look and act and think differently than this world, right? Then lastly, with this I'll close. It says here in the latter part of verse 4, these have been redeemed from mankind as first fruits for God and the Lamb. Again, some have misunderstood this, I believe, but the use of first fruits here. In 1 Corinthians 15:23, it says, but each in his own order, Christ the first fruits, and then at his coming, those who belong to Christ. And first fruit there is kind of used in a sense of Christ being the firstborn from the dead, and then there were others who were going to follow. And some have taken this and say, well, you see here, you've got these people who are saved in the tribulation, and they go and they witness, and then a bunch of people are saved from that, and they're the ones who go into the kingdom. And so they're like the first set, and then there's more to follow. And they try to somehow squeeze all that into the tribulation and so forth. And I think that that kind of, you don't have to use first fruits in that way. The Septuagint often uses the first fruit as a gift or an offering, something that is set aside for the Lord. In James 1:18, of his own will, he brought us forth by the word of truth that we should be a kind of, see how he's kind of uses of first fruits to his creatures. So the redeemed are a group of people taken out of fallen man unto the Lord. You know, the first fruit in under the law, when harvest time came, you took a little bit of that, and it was kind of like a tithe to the Lord, that first fruit that represented the whole. And so you don't have to take that as anything more than a look, a description of saints of God. So let me just kind of bring this to an end here. I know there's all sorts of stuff going on here, so I don't want to get too so detailed that we kind of miss the main theme here. But it's important to see that John is using examples in the Old Testament to convey what he is seeing. And most often these examples are from that which the Jew, and hopefully us, if we are familiar with the Word of God, would have been able to pick up on when we study that. And what we see here, how verses, I think, this verses 4 and 5 here, when we don't know the Bible well, or we don't understand how the Bible fits together, we read verses like that, or 1 Corinthians 7, and men have jumped to conclusions that have done more to destroy the church than actually open up the Bible to us. So I'm trying to be careful here that we don't, none of us would fall into such a trap. It would have saved a lot of problems over the last 2,000 years if people had maybe been more faithful in their understanding of these texts. Well, next week we will see that last personage, the great whore of Babylon. But she's only going to be mentioned and described more fully when she is destroyed. Next week we're going to spend more time in verses 6 through 13 dealing with the reality of hell, because it's a passage that deals quite a bit with the wrath of God and what that looks like. And so we're going to spend some time trying to develop some of the ideas of hell and those things. So we'll stop there today. Are there any questions or comments? Thank you for
your attention. You are dismissed.